Fishing for the Truth, Perception, Apprehension, and the Quest for Human Blessedness was presented by Andrew Kern at Gutenberg College's Conference on Education, Mastery, Not Factory, How We Learn What Matters, on February 22, 2014. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Audience participation was not recorded. It is hoped that Mr. Kern's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay. Andrew Kern is the head of the Searcy Institute.
So you just saw this morning why I love this school so much. Did you see that, where how gently and kindly David Crabtree threw down the gauntlet? I just love that. The courage that this school has shown for, what is it, 30, 40 years now? Well, with McKenzie Study Center, it's just mind-blowing. That's why it's such an honor for me to be here. I want to begin by thanking you for being here, and I want to thank Gutenberg for asking me to be here. I live in North Carolina now. I've been following Gutenberg since about the late 90s, I suppose, when I lived in Boise, was teaching a bunch of kids there in high school in a homeschool sort of co-op, and a number of those students came here, and of course they were the best students Gutenberg's ever had. So so what a privilege to stand in front of friends of Gutenberg, allies in the battle, and to address you. My name is Andrew Kern. People often ask what CIRCE is. It stands for the Center for Independent Research on Classical Education. From that research comes consulting and resources. So CIRCE actually is I can't speak French, but if I could, you'd hear this correctly, a double entendre. It also stands for Consulting and Integrated Resources for Classical Educators. What drives us at CIRCE is a very simple question. In 1993, I helped start a school in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where I had the privilege of meeting Ken. And at the time, I knew everything about classical education, and then started thinking about it. So then I started to ask myself, well, what is classical education? And that's really the question that drives the CIRCE Institute. What is classical education? And for 20 years, I've been trying to figure it out, and I'd like to introduce you into my confusion and lostness this morning. But thank you so much to David, to Jack, to Tim, to Peter Waringa, to the whole community here at Gutenberg, to my old students. I don't think any are here today because it's rather a while since I taught them. It was 2001. I left Boise, so most of them will have graduated. But maybe they'll come back and get their caps. That would be fun. And thank you to the friends of Gutenberg, Kimberly Yon and others of you who have hosted me and encourage me to come out here, and Tucker and Bella, thank you for being part of the apprenticeship. My purpose this morning is really kind of, when I think of what I'm actually about in things like this, I always start laughing at myself. Because what I want to do this morning is to think about thinking. That's a specific thing. I want to think about thinking. And then from that, I hope that a bigger purpose will be fulfilled. I want to be a blessing to you. And I also want to enjoy your company. So that's my goal. But I have two preliminary thoughts. And then I'm going to tell you my conclusion. Because if I don't, I won't get there. Then I'll start talking about whatever it is that I'm talking about. First preliminary thought. Even if everything that was talked about in this conference and at Gutenberg and in the classroom and, you know, all the discussions, even if I thought that everything everybody said was incorrect, which I didn't, but even if I thought that everything was incorrect, I would still be excited by what was happening here and by what is happening here because of what people are thinking about. There are certain things that if you get it wrong, it doesn't matter all that much, because it doesn't matter. There are some things that if you get it wrong, it matters more, and therefore we're afraid to think about it. There are questions, therefore, that we go through our lives suppressing. We, in fact, have made it illegal to ask the important questions that you can get educated on in our schools in this country. We've outlawed education in our schools. But these questions, even if you get the answers wrong, these questions themselves are life, if you take them seriously. Because frankly, in this life, we can't get them right. Not ultimately, not perfectly. We're only going to see through a fog. But if we won't look because it's foggy, then we won't move. We won't even try to walk into the fog, which means we'll just sit down in front of it and freeze to death. There's a wisdom in the asking, in other words. And I want to just encourage you here at Gutenberg and in this community to keep asking. Keep asking those questions. My second preliminary thought came to me also last night, and I wrote it down, and I thought, this relates. Two parts to it. First, nobody has any idea what an idea is. And second, nobody knows what an emotion is. Therefore, I'm going to tell you, and you won't be able to prove me wrong, even if I am. Okay? So here's a, I don't know if I'd call this a definition, but this is what I think an idea is. An idea is a wave of energy that excites everything it touches, excites in an atomic sense. An idea is a wave of energy that excites everything it touches, making them glow, burning the dross out of them, purging them of error, vanity, fear, and sloth, arousing, purifying, and energizing the mind that welcomes it in. An idea is what a feeling longs to be in its melancholy, what a feeling hopes to become in its cheerfulness, and what it strives to realize in its optimism. An emotion is the outward movement of an idea. That's why it's called e-mote, right? Motion, outward motion. It's the outward movement of an idea as it touches the physiology of the person who is contemplating it and striving to realize it. An emotion is our reaction to the idea as it works its way from the inner treasure chamber of our souls through our bodies in order to be incarnated as an artifact. The purpose of an emotion is to make it easier to love. Married people understand that. Okay, so those are just preliminary thoughts. And by the way, if you don't understand what I just said, I wouldn't worry about it. I don't either. Here's my conclusion. The purpose of life is to glorify God by becoming his likeness, thus enjoying him with all of our being. Another way, well, let me repeat that because some of you are actually honoring me by writing, but you won't remember a thing I say if you do. You know that, right? The purpose of life is to glorify God. Can you believe I'm using index cards? Can you believe I'm using index cards? Yeah. See, I told you I can go linear. The purpose of life, by the way, speaking of linear, I love this church because it works like my mind. It's the circular. People like me need circularity so that we can feel some degree of stability. The purpose of life is to glorify God by becoming his likeness, thus enjoying him with all of our being. Another way of putting that is to say that the purpose of life is to realize the idea of yourself by embodying it. To realize the idea of yourself by embodying it. You are a logos, not the logos. You are a logos, an idea. And your task is to incarnate yourself. Your task is to give expression to who you were made to be. You are, in other words, both artist and artifact. The good news is you're under a master teacher. You have a pattern set for you to imitate. And that pattern has a form and it has a content. The form of the pattern, the form that our master has set for us, and I mean master in the sense of master apprenticeship here, the form that the master of all wisdom has set for us is the form of the incarnate logos. The pattern of taking a logos and incarnating it, embodying it. Taking something that seems abstract and whatever, unknowable, and giving it flesh and blood. That's the pattern that we are to imitate. If you want a concrete, notice the pattern, if you want a concrete expression of that from the scriptures, you can read any sentence that you like, but there's one that flows through the whole Bible, and that is the pattern of the temple. You are the temple of the living God. If you want, therefore, to know yourself, if you want to know the order of your soul, if you want to know what you are made of and what your responsibilities to yourself are, look at the temple. If you want to know what God thinks of you, look at the temple. You know, in Exodus 26 to 40, the last 15 chapters of the book of Exodus, or is it 21? Now, yeah, 26. Exodus 26 to 40. Three times you get the same basic description of the temple, which if you're just reading for action, doesn't do a whole lot for you. Some of you who grew up in Christian homes, maybe you got those through the Bible in a year things and you were starting to read through the Bible and then you got to Exodus 20. Right? That's where the Ten Commandments come in. And then you have the Book of the Covenant. And then from 26 to 40, it's just the description of the temple. I was reading it recently. I thought, why on earth? Three times. I mean, we read it already. But have you ever talked to somebody who's just fallen in love? Right? Have you ever noticed how they don't stop after the first description? They want you to see. They want you to hear. They want you to feel what they're feeling. I'm convinced that at some level that's what's going on in Exodus. In 19, Moses actually entered into the cloud of God's glory. And I'm convinced that while he was in there, he had certainly some sort of ecstatic experience, but he saw heaven. So in Exodus 26 to 40, he's giving a description, a blueprint of what he saw. In Exodus, three times it says, in the first description, it says, see that you make it after the pattern. He loves the temple. That's the thing we've got to understand. He loves it. And there's a phrase in there that I particularly like where it says that it is for beauty and for glory. That is what God thinks of you. He calls you his temple. He wants you to be dressed in the priest's garments for beauty and for glory. He wants you to be continually embodying in flesh and blood. He wants you to be continually embodying his glory and his beauty. That's the form that he gives us to imitate, the pattern. The second thing is the content. The content that he gives us to imitate is love. Love and its many splendored radiances, right? So that's sort of a first proposition that I'm going to end my talk with. And then there's a second point. Okay, eventually this is going to get more interesting, I promise. But right now I'm just giving you my conclusion so that I get it said. Every time you think and act, you have an inner object. Usually we don't consciously realize why we're doing things. And even when we do, that's only part of why we're doing things. Every time we think and act, we have an inner object. An inner objective. And that inner objective is to realize some idea. Now get this. Every time you do something, you are trying to realize some inner idea that is smaller than you. Like, for example, calculus. The nature of pi. Either one. The nature of an artistic element of a note in music, of a line in art. You're trying to realize some idea that is smaller than you. The nature of a star. The nature of an atom, the nature of the distributive property. You're trying to learn the truth of a Flannery O'Connor novel, right? Or the idea of a logos. That is what makes us move. But the key might be, well, a key to this is that you have to remember that these ideas are smaller than you. In fact, in a certain sense, your task is to take possession of them because they're already yours. Now, the reason it's important to remember that these things are smaller than you is because every time you do this, every time you think and act, you are practicing. You are assembling, if you want to use a really horrible metaphor, you are putting together the pieces in a Lego house, right? You are piece by piece, item by item, step by step, you are bringing every truth that you realize into your own soul. Do you see this? You're welcoming these truths into your soul. And if my definition or my idea of an idea before is anything like right, then you're not just taking symbols, looking at them, and drawing conclusions about how they relate to each other. You're welcoming realities and energies, if I can use that term. I know that's New Agey, but you're welcoming the Spirit into yourself, the Spirit of truth into yourself, and he changes things. And this builds up. You're practicing in little things like math, like grammar, like music. You're practicing in little things so that these things can come into you and they can purify you, they can purge you. You might be thinking, well, what on earth does math have to do with that? Well, have you ever got math wrong? Dumb question, right? One of the most amazing things that's happened to my mind in the last year is that I finally came to understand the distributive property. It's not that I didn't know it. You know, I had it memorized. It was symbols that I could move around on paper. But while I was teaching a group of math teachers how to teach, they took me through the distributive property, or they forced me to live by my own principles and think about it. And I suddenly saw it. And all of a sudden, algebra completely opened up to me. See, the thing is, when you don't understand a truth, there's a great barrier. You're disempowered. But when you do perceive it and you welcome it into yourself and you embrace it, you are changed. You are changed. You are transformed. You really are, to use the modern language, you really are empowered. The trouble with modern education is they want the power without the truth, right? And so they get power, but only over people and over things. They don't get power that is a modest, humble power before things as a stewardship. So any truth can come into us and purges us of error and cleanses us and enables us to do something. And by the way, one of the most important things that I see, that I saw yesterday here at Gutenberg, and I've seen this all of my life I've seen it ever since I got involved in classical education, and I occasionally saw this in school, and so did you. The best teachers, what do they do? No, let me rephrase that. What is the consequence of a lesson when you're sitting under the best teachers? Energy. People don't sleep in their classes, right? In fact, one of the great functions of a teacher is to arouse the intellectual energy of the people in his presence and to direct it toward a right end. Fundamentally, that's what a teacher is doing, arousing their energy and making it move. So we call that inspiration sometimes, right? To breathe in. That's what a great teacher does. That's what truth does. Why? It's not the teacher doing it, it's the truth doing it. Truth is energizing. It fills us with hope. Heck, it sets us free if you let it. And that enables us to move forward toward the goal, toward the God, who is the final object of all thought. And I'm amazed by pragmatism of our culture. You've probably heard the statement that I've heard it ascribed to Chesterton, but also denied. The trouble with pragmatism is it doesn't work. Have you heard that? It doesn't. One thing I've learned in education is everybody wants to be taught practical things. You go do teacher training, teachers come to our conference, and their review is always, give me the practical stuff. Did you ever, here's the most practical thing anybody will ever tell you. Without energy, you can't work, right? Here's what I see in schools across the country, Christian and private and public. Teachers are being completely drained of their energy through purposeless work, and students are being totally drained of their energy through purposeless activity. Purpose energizes. Truth energizes. It's astounding to see what a true statement received into the soul does to the soul that receives it. And it encourages us. See, if you're actually taught that there's knowable truth, and then you find one, and you welcome it, and you get excited by it, it gives you hope. But if you're taught from kindergarten onward by the pattern, not by being told the fact, but by the pattern of teaching, by the disconnectedness of teaching, by the pointlessness of teaching, by the performance art of supposed teaching and learning, by the emptiness of everything that's happening, if that's your experience of school and somebody attaches the word education to that, and you start thinking that's what education is, you think you don't want it. And by the time you're in seventh grade, you get in a debate with somebody, because, you know, seventh graders are always arguing, like everybody else, but you get in a discussion with somebody, and about 2 or 3 minutes into it, it's demanding too much of you, so what does the kid say? One of two things. Well, you're entitled to your opinion, or that's true for you. Both of those statements are false. You have to earn the right to an opinion, first of all. You are not entitled to an opinion about something you haven't thought about. You know why? Because you're responsible to other people when you speak to them. Do you understand this, that when you speak, you can bless or you can curse somebody? That can happen if you're being nice or mean, right? Okay. But if you speak falsehood, even if you don't know you are, you're cursing the person that you're talking to. You're confusing that person. You're disordering his mind. The first person to do that, you recall, was Satan, right? You are speaking like the father of lies. You're following his pattern. You're cursing the person. You are sucking his life out of him by doing that. And so if you tell another person that if you think that you're entitled to your opinion because, after all, you are you, it's a stewardship. An opinion is a stewardship. You have to steward your thoughts. And what was the second one? That's true for you. Okay. Well, that happily, no seventh grader has ever said that and meant it. But some adults do if they're like, say, at Stanford or UO. Is it UO or OU? Oh, got it. Okay. If you believe that something can be true for, you know, that something can be true for you, what you've basically just done is jumped into the abyss of despair. And if you actually accept that, there's no hope for you. The only solution to that thought is repentance. When seventh graders say it happily, they're usually parroting. But when you hear a child say that, you need to immediately, in their presence, you need to fall on your knees, start kissing their feet and begging God to heal them right then and there, because they're on the very brink of hell. I was going to do this conclusion briefly, but anyway, okay. So, next point. You realize an idea or a truth, and I'm using those two terms here at least synonymously. By an idea, therefore, I don't mean something that you form in your head. That's a concept. Okay, an idea exists independently of your mind. That's why you can pass it from yours to somebody else's, which is pretty cool. You realize an idea or a truth when you can incarnate it. You can put it in a song. You can put it in a poem. Heck, you can put it in a sentence. Maybe even an equation. An act of Christian charity. In fact, you can understand the idea, I think, to a limited, very limited extent, you can understand the idea of Christian charity by reading the gospel. You can cognitively understand it, but you certainly don't realize it until you act on it. This is why sometimes, you know, you see somebody on the side of the street and he's begging, and you know this guy's a druggie. You know he's going to use the money. You can tell by looking at him that he's been using meth. And you're thinking, if I give him the money, he's just going to blow it off. You do need to think about that. But generally speaking, it's probably better just to act on Christian charity and then pray. Right? Generally speaking. Because otherwise, we can be withholding ourselves from people. And really, the issue isn't so much that person. This is going to sound terrible, but I'll say it anyway. You can fix it. He's probably already ruined anyway, and your money's not going to do any more damage. But maybe you are too. And maybe the act of giving to him isn't for his sake, it's for yours. See, I think when we pass people on the street like that, there's two impulses in our soul. One is the impulse to rise up and to say, God, I thank you that I am not like that person. Right? Do you feel that? I feel that all the time. It's so ridiculous. In fact, I was going to say something like this to you before if I ever get to my introduction, I'll say this. The thing you need to know about me is that if you actually knew me, if you knew how my soul operates and what goes on in there, there's no way you'd listen to me speak. You would be ashamed and you would run. And so some of you are thinking, well, then why are you talking? They asked me to. Talk to them. But the corollary is that if that troubles you so much that you couldn't listen to me, then you've done something even worse, according to Jesus. You've looked at me and said, I thank God I'm not like him. And that might be the unforgivable sin, if you hold to it. Because it's the one who says, Lord, have mercy on me, the sinner. He's the one who goes away justified. The person who's looking at the other person and saying, thank God I'm not like that, is securing hell for himself. We need to be aware of our tendency to do that. You realize Christian charity not when you think about it, but when you do it, when you incarnate it. You realize any thought when you incarnate it. In fact, and by I'm including symbols here for incarnation, like a word or a painting. Okay, I'm going to even push it further and say that at the core of everything I want to share with you this morning, it is the act of trying to incarnate a truth that makes it possible for you to understand it, to embrace it, to realize it. So really, all I've said so far, in case I've completely confused you with any of these fancy words or whatever, all I've said so far is that there is truth and that we don't know it until we incarnate it. Okay, and we have to receive it into ourselves in order to incarnate it. Okay, this is how we take possession of what is ours in Christ. That's the next point. This is how we take possession of what is ours in Christ. Now, I'll just take a moment to explain what I mean by that. Does anybody know what is yours in Christ? Have you ever stopped to think, what exactly has Christ given me? The answer might surprise you just a little bit, and then you'll think about who he is, and then you'll go, oh yeah, of course. He's given you everything. And he says this over and over again in the Gospels in the New Testament. it says it constantly. It starts in Genesis 1. You can have everything. But in order to take possession of it, you have to deny yourself this tree for a while. Instead of taking possession of the creation, they were enslaved by the creation by demanding it. Okay, then he calls on the Israelites, and he gives them the opportunity. He says, take possession of the land. Instead of taking possession of the land, they're possessed by the land, and they worship the false gods. Our problem is not that we don't have enough. Our problem is that too much has us. We are enslaved, constantly enslaved by... You know what we're enslaved by? We're enslaved by the fear that we don't have enough. We don't know how to handle the inheritance. So we do one of two things. Either we take what we do have, what we know we have, what we feel that we have, and we run off and spend it till it's all gone. And then we think, oh, it's all gone. I'll go back and be a servant. We come back home and we find out we didn't even touch the surface of it. Or we're afraid that somebody else might blow it off, or we're afraid that somebody might take it away from us. So we go out, we work so hard. We never bother relating to our Father. We just work and work and work and work because somebody might take it away from us. Do you understand? It is all yours. It is already all yours in Christ. And that's the problem the Corinthians, for example, had. Read Corinthians and look at the sins that they commit. Every single one of them is rooted in the fact that they're envy-driven. They're afraid of losing something. For example, Paul says to the Corinthians, somebody defrauded you. So you take him to court. Why? Well, that's an easy question to answer, isn't it? Because he defrauded me. That's why I took him to court. I don't want to lose my possessions. I don't want to be taken advantage of. Well, that's the thought of a person who doesn't think everything is his. If everything's yours, who cares if somebody takes something from you? Your Father's not going to run out of resources. Your task is to take possession of what is already yours. And that begins, I would suggest to you, with taking possession of the truth. And what I want to really strongly emphasize here is that this is a primal duty. Okay, you can enjoy it. Yes, it's an ecstasy of joy. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. I mean, you ever think about that? And we seem to think that, we seem to think like Immanuel Kant. Well, just remember, Immanuel Kant, but Genghis Khan. That's my lame joke of the day. Well, I'll tell more. We can't shirk this duty. We cannot shirk this duty no matter how much we're scared of the pleasure it gives us. Everything is yours. And here's why. Because if you don't take possession, it is under a curse. If you don't take possession, then there's no hope for what you're supposed to take possession of. And that is the essence both of learning and of teaching. Both of learning and of teaching, taking possession. Okay? And that, therefore, dissolves the wall of partition between the academic life and the rest of life, the real life, thus giving meaning to academics and purging it of its pretense. You all know what I mean by that, right? I mean, my goodness, is it easy to look really smart if you can quote people, right? And if you can move puzzle pieces around. But you can do that without having the foggiest notion of the reality that you're talking about. In other words, Jesus is the truth made flesh, and your goal is to be like him, who is the only thing bigger than you. When you are, you will be a blessing to everything that moves within the radiance of your influence. If I can summarize all of this, it is be filled with the Holy Spirit. Okay, that's my conclusion. So now I want to make this more interesting. Has anybody here ever read Thomas Aquinas? Anybody? Has anybody read about Thomas Aquinas? This is not a quiz question. This is a curiosity question. There's no wrong answer. Okay, so if you were to go to heaven and bump into Thomas Aquinas, what would you expect him to be doing? Anybody, just throw out some answers. How many of you practicing the presence of God. Okay. Now, can you put that in a sort of a physical thing he might be doing? I like that answer. I just don't get it. Talking with Christ. Okay. Good. Singing. Anybody else? Parsing. Yeah, that makes sense, right? Thomas Aquinas. I would illustrate what Tim's getting at for those of you who haven't read Thomas, but let me just encourage you, look up Thomas Aquinas online. Everything he's written is free. And just read the first bit of the Summa and you'll get why he said that. Parsing. Cutting things up, right? Okay. That's what he'd be doing. Singing, practicing the presence of God. Makes sense. Anybody here a fisherman? Oh, by the way, I'm gonna go, this is for my comfort zone now. I'm going to go nonlinear. Okay. Anybody here fish much? You fish? Okay. When you fish, what kind of fishing do you do? And do you fly fish? Okay, and otherwise, just what is it called if you're not fly fishing? What is that? Not worthy of a name? Yeah. Casting, okay. Okay, anybody else fish? Tim? Yeah, I thought everybody in Oregon fishes a lot. I guess not. Okay. So here's a question for you fishermen. Is fishing an art or a science or something else? A little of both? Okay. In what way is it a science? And that's science, understanding the creature. Okay? Okay. I like that way of putting it. Okay. And how is it an art? Okay. Yeah. Oh, those aren't just made in factories? Aha. Okay. So your goal is to trick this creature that you've got to know. Okay. So it's like teaching. Okay. Okay. Tim, you want to add anything about it, the science or art element of it? Okay. Okay. So in order to do the art, what do you need to know and to be able to do and whatever? What are some of the requirements to get good at it? What's that?
Patience.
Okay. Okay. Practice. Yeah. Okay. Practice and patience. Those go together. Skill. Okay. Good. You've got to have skill, practice, patience, practice in order to gain the skill, right? Has anybody here ever mastered a skill without practicing? And I don't mean relative to me, okay? I mean, like Ken could say, well, compared to you, yeah. Has anybody ever mastered, well, okay, I asked that. What other things do you all do besides fishing that involves practice and skill and driving? Oh, that's good, yeah. Is driving an art or a science or something else? Some of both? Okay, what would be, anybody feel free to throw in something here. What is the artistic element of driving, or in what way is it an art? You mean because they'll have different designs? Do you mean because there are different designs, they look different? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the interesting thing about cars is I'm increasingly convinced that if there weren't everywhere, and we just appeared in a world where there were cars, never having seen one, I think we would think they're the most hideously ugly thing in the universe. But we're so accustomed to them. Anyway, sorry, some people love cars, and I have nothing against that. And let's look at the act of driving. In what way is it an art? Okay. Now, why do you say that's an art? The manner in which you drive. So an art has to do with how you see things. Okay. But doesn't the science too? Okay. So are you saying there's a relationship between art and science? Oh, weird. Okay. Yes. That's fascinating. Was it last night we talked about, the idea of second nature, or the idea of internalizing? Do you know that I read somewhere, I live in Concord, North Carolina. It's important that I say that because, one, you never say Concord to a Southerner, okay? We were not. And second, Concord is the NASCAR center of the world, right? Dale Earnhardt Boulevard is just down the road. Okay, so I don't know where I read this, but it's a big deal there. And I read somewhere that when a driver in a race is making a decision to pass another, the decision and the action happen faster than the neurons can fire to make it happen. Isn't that bizarre? At that speed. There's absolutely, the whole activity is what we might at this point call pre-conscious. That blows my mind. Kim, I said it? Ah, okay, okay. So when you're being an artist, when you are performing an art, you have to be judging continually what to do. Okay, okay, Ken? The expression of science as we interact with each other. Unfold that for me a little bit. And so the skills are, would you say techniques? Okay. And have you ever noticed how some people seem to just take to a skill set in various areas? They don't even seem to have to think about it. And another person has to work so hard on it. Like sports, we see it in sports very clearly, but we also see it in the classroom. Some people intuitively grasp math. Others intuitively grasp sentences. Some kids learn how to read without ever doing phonics. And they become the foundation of modern American reading programs. In other words, kids who don't need to learn how to read are the ones that we're going to base how to teach on. See, some people just, they have gift. And maybe there's a level of coincidence or environmental factors or whatever that play into it. But not if there's not a potential, right? Now, I believe that all of us have the faculty to do everything, but not in the same, not everything, but you know what I mean. I probably don't know what I mean. We all have the faculty to learn all the things that we need to learn to some degree. But we also have to accept, I am never going to be a good singer or musician. God created music with me in mind. He thought, that guy is so arrogant, I've got to do something. I know, I'll make music. I know, you're all thinking, who does he think he is? God just thinks about him. Well, yes, he does. Okay, he does. Let me tell you something I learned about God when I had a little daughter. When she was in, you remember Katie? When she was in third grade, she came walking into my office rather abruptly, and she kind of, I remember, full force kind of, not, well, anyway, very assertively puts on my desk a picture of herself. Kind of gives me that look that daughters give their dads and walks out. Still on my desk. She knew perfectly well. She knew perfectly well that I would totally welcome that assertion of her presence into my life and that I would want to keep it there, right? Sorry, that's a digression. Random thought, question. Have you ever tried to say something, begun to say it, and stopped and thought to yourself, no, that's not it? How do you know? I don't mean how do you remember. How do you know that's not it? I mean, isn't it words that we think with? Is that not what we use to think? So how do you know? I mean, just say it. It's a feeling? Feeling about what? Recognized? The idea that you're trying to communicate, that's such a rich concept right there, isn't being recognized by your words. That's really interesting. That's really interesting. Recognize. So our words recognize the idea. Metaphorically, I assume you mean. I'm not saying anything. I'm asking. So we're back to the judgment issue again. So would it be like if a car racer is he thinks to himself or feels within himself, it's time to pass, begins to and realizes, no, it's not. Is there something parallel to that to trying to express a sentence? That you begin to express it and then you go, no, that's not it. Isn't that a weird thought? Never think too hard about yourself, you will get lost. Actually, I don't believe that. I used to think that, but I don't anymore. It's a fascinating thought to me, though, that you can begin to think a thought, you can begin to put it into words, but and it's not like you have to be trained to do this when you're 2 years old. I mean, what's a child doing with language? I love to think about people will get to calculus and they'll say, it's so hard. Do you not remember what it was like to learn language? Don't you remember how many years it took you to figure out how to talk? Do you remember how many years it took you to learn how to count? Calculus is nothing after that. Now, admittedly, you have other pressures now. I get that. But it's not as hard as you think. You did the hard work when you learned how to say 3, 4, 5. Sorry, I got excited there and forgot what I was talking about. Am I in the middle of a thought? What? Oh, good. Good. Okay. Okay, Brandon. Where are you? There you are. And Elliot, too. Question about your music playing. The other day, by the way, you have to use that hat. I don't know if you usually do or not, but that hat is perfect that you were wearing the other day. It's perfect. Did you make any mistakes? I didn't hear any of them. How do you know that you made a mistake? Huh. But what, you didn't measure up? What was the ratio of failing? Oh, okay. Okay. Didn't go according to plan. Okay. That's true. Are there mistakes that you could make playing the fiddle that I could recognize? Like what? And why would that be a mistake? You buy that, Elliot?
I do.
Okay, this explains to me why I've always been opposed to music. What you're basically saying to me is that you're playing in such a way as to set me up and disappoint me. Or maybe appoint me. But in any case, what you're doing is you're manipulating me. To what end? To what end? What are you trying to get out of me? A donation? A purchase? Well, no kidding. Manipulation is to move. But where are you trying to move me? Yeah, that's what I was wondering. He says it depends on the song. Is that true? It depends on the song? Thank you. The song for your sister. In that song, somewhere between 60 and 90 seconds, you did a very dramatic drag on the fiddle. Do you know what I'm talking about? Why did you do that? It was appropriate. Appropriate context based on the domains of expectation. What do you mean by domains of expectation? I love the phrase, but what does it mean? I'm sorry? Okay, so there is a pattern, and they have set us up to expect that pattern, and they've done it within a tradition that uses these tropes, schemes. Okay? What's that? Right. So then the reason when I got to high school, or even junior high, the reason that I could easily listen to pop music, but I found it really hard to listen to, say, Baroque music, because I just watched Brideshead, and that's how they say it there. If I listen to Baroque music, I don't get it, right? It doesn't speak to me in the same way, because I'm not participating in that tradition, okay? Although I do recognize that, man, it's pretty amazing stuff going on. So the tradition that we're a part of, that influences our expectations. Does it also set a parameter on what you can do to me? I use the term manipulation, which I think is a negative term. I would defend myself against you manipulating me. But is there a... You say it. How often does that happen? Isn't it a question of degree, though? I mean, I don't really know. First of all, I'd have to trust you. But second of all, I don't really know what you're trying to do because I don't know music well enough. Huh. It is trust, isn't it? To sit in a person's concert is to trust that person. Or else to put up a barrier to protect yourself. Just a critic. What's better, a listener or a critic? That's because you're a performer. But at the same time, okay, maybe not of me, but you are critiquing what I'm saying in order to respond, right? Okay. So it's back to those judgments again. We make these driving judgments. We make them so fast we don't even know that's what we're doing. But it is how we think, isn't it? Okay? Got it. And in school they call that summative assessment, right? So you look back on the whole process and you evaluate against some standards consciously. Nice and slow, slow enough that you can actually write it. I got to ask a question to the tutors here. Any of you, any tutors, anybody here who's a teacher, is what they're describing about the relationship between the musician and the audience analogous to the relationship between a teacher and the class, the teacher and the students? Anybody want to jump in on that, or should I just stand here looking embarrassed? Yes, Emily. Okay, can everybody hear that? If I understand, Emily, what she's saying is that the performer, the musical performer, is trying to move the audience towards something that they have experienced. And what that can happen in varying degrees. Okay, do you enjoy helping others experience the music in the same way you did? Let me see if I can bring that down to something concrete so we can think about a specific. And let's stay with the song for your sister. Would it be accurate to say that in that song, at least a part of your intention was to honor your sister? Okay, so then was it so that what you were trying to do was to take her something about her totality, her gestalt, her the idea of who she is, and you were trying to make a model of that? That's a bad metaphor maybe, but you were trying to reduce that to something musical that we could then see her. You didn't want us to see the music per se, you want us to see her and then honor her. Okay. How do you know? Back to that question again. I buy that, but hey, just one second. I'm going to call on you just a second because I want to hear what you have to say, but I'll lose this if I do. I lost it. Go ahead. Feels right. Okay, good point. Good point. Did everybody hear that? He's comparing it to a massage. You're manipulating another person, but in a very literal sense, not a metaphorical trying to break them down and requesting it, yeah. Paying for it. Right. So when we're disordered and out of line, so to speak, when we are feeling within ourselves this discord, whether it be physical or otherwise, we're perfectly happy to let people manipulate us. That's interesting. Yes. Would you agree you might not like it, though? Resonates against or do you mean with? Okay. Ah, okay. That's really helpful. Did everybody hear that? There's a similarity, but it's very similar in that they're trying to get you to experience something. But there's a difference in that the teacher is not only trying to get you to experience something else, but to be able to give somebody else that experience, to train you in it. Let me make a suggestion here. What if there's two kinds of teaching that are very interactive, but probably not separable in and of themselves, but can be thought about separately, if you see what I mean. what if one kind of teaching is where you're trying to get somebody to share the experience, and another kind of teaching is where you're trying to help somebody master a skill? Does that make sense? Would you buy that distinction? Be equipped. Good. You're equipping them. Good. Kind of like an apprenticeship. Yes. What are the first two? Okay. Okay. Wow. Huh. Okay. Well, let me start my talk now. My text for today is in Dante. It's a book called The Paradiso, and it's probably the most difficult poem to read ever written, and that is because it should have been, thus proving that it is the greatest poem ever written. But in it are these words, which are actually fairly clear. Far worselessly he leaves the shore, more full of error than he was before, who fishes for the truth but lacks the art. Have you ever gone truth fishing? Did you catch anything? See, one of the things, the reason this passage is so powerful to me is because about, well, starting, I would argue, starting with Descartes and Bacon, a pattern of thinking developed that was initially not aware of this fact, but eventually became aware of the fact. This pattern of thinking is based on the fact that there is no such thing as knowable truth. Okay? When you read about it in Descartes and Bacon, what they've done is, and I don't think they're aware of it, what they've done is they've redefined truth. Bacon says knowledge is power. He's redefining what knowledge is. The perfection of that Bacon theory, and by perfection I mean the utter destruction of it, the utter realization of its destructive influence, is in John Dewey. And I like a lot about Dewey, and he was a nice guy, so don't take this as a personal slam. It's an analysis of an argument. John Dewey wrote an essay that I want to encourage you to read. It's the only thing he ever wrote that is relatively easy to read. He found that grammar didn't suit his purposes, and thus became an incredibly influential educator, go figure. I remember reading in 1993 or 4, an Education Week headline. It looked like, you know, Kennedy is slain, those huge letters, and it said, "Should we teach grammar?" The conclusion, of course, was no. Dewey's essay is called On the Impact of Darwinism Upon Philosophy. And it begins like this. And I don't remember the exact words, but I think this is correct. I think this is word for word. When Charles Darwin wrote his book On the Origin of Species, everybody knew that a scientific revolution had taken place. That's Dewey's first mistake. Darwin was not performing a scientific revolution. It was the coup de grace. But he goes on, what even the experts failed to see was that an intellectual revolt had occurred that introduced a new intellectual temper. And those two phrases, intellectual revolt and intellectual temper, are what he goes on in 12 pages. It's not very long. In 12 pages, he describes that intellectual revolt. Now, I have a question for you. If in the 1859, Charles Darwin wrote a book called On the Origin of Species that Dewey said 40 or so years later was an intellectual revolt, what was Darwin revolting against? Well, we would say that. Dewey doesn't. Okay, ultimately, every rebellion is against God. But in what specific way do you suppose Darwin was revolting against God? And even put it, Dewey was an atheist, so as far as I can tell. So put it in those terms. What would an atheist acknowledge Darwin was revolting against? Well, it's fascinating. He looks at the title of the book. He says even the very title expresses that revolt. On the Origin of Species. Prior to Darwin, people had given up on chemistry and physics not needing God, but they still needed God for life, right? If your God is a God who you only believe in because you need him to fill an argument, well, you know, that's the way you would think. But in Darwin's work, we're revolting against God. We can set God aside. But now life itself, get this now, now life itself has no stable foundation. Species have origins. Now, the revolt in Dewey's approach or conviction is against Aristotle. It's against, I would say, it's against Christian classical education, the Christian classical mind. Why? Because you and I read Corinthians and it says, While the outer man is wasting away, the inner man is being transformed from glory to glory. For we do not look on the things that are visible, but we look on the eternal. I forget the word. Somebody help me on this. We look on the eternal, and is it the unchanging? The invisible. Yeah, we look on the invisible and the eternal. Dewey's entire essay is about how that's a hang-up that modern man is over now. In other words, the intellectual revolt is the revolt against permanent things. The revolt against anything unchanging. We're over that. That was an illusion. That was a hang-up. We are over that now. Now the modern mind has a new intellectual temper. It's not that the modern mind thinks about all this stuff. It's that the modern mind feels this way. And what is the intellectual temper of the modern mind? What's the opposite of permanence? Change. You could run for office. Hard to imagine this ever happening. But somebody could. I would suggest to you, if you ever want to run for office, you could get up in front of the American people and say, we need change. Whatever you do, don't define it. Just say that, okay? What? Don't get political. You could just say that, though. You could say, we need change. And half the people in America would go, oh, yeah, change. And then when that doesn't work for 8 years, they'll throw that guy out and get a person who's a quasi-permanent person, a person who believes in permanence, at least on the surface, until he gets into office. And then he'll mess up the country even more. And then somebody else would come along and say, since change didn't work, he'll say, I offer you change you can believe in. Now, I don't want to get political. I can't even imagine that ever happening, because no people would accept that. But if you can imagine a country that so is immersed in a love of instability and chaos, okay, that's how it would play itself out in politics. Plays itself out in business. You got chaos theory seeping into business back in the 90s. What a joke. The modern intellectual temper rejects anything that is eternal and invisible, right? That's not a conclusion to an argument. That's the end of every argument. Because you see, the truth to be true, it's always true. It's unchanging everywhere and at all times. It will always be true that window right there is to my right. Now you're all going, hey, wait a minute, when you're not there anymore, it won't be. I'm talking about right now. You can't undo that fact. It's there. Forever, it will have been there at this moment. Truth is eternal. It's unchanging. It's invisible. So what is he saying? If I were to reduce Dewey's philosophy of education to a premise, it would be this. There is no truth to know, so we have to teach kids how to adapt. Make sense? We have to adapt. That's what parents mean when they say, if you're homeschooling and they say to you, how are your kids going to socialize? What they mean is, how are they going to adapt to their environment? Something about people who adapt. We all do it all the time. If a fist is flying toward my face, I'm going to move. Most of the time. If I'm fast enough. But what if I shouldn't? Adapters are incapable of doing anything heroic. Martyrs don't adapt. And what we're heading into now, in my opinion, is a time of crisis in our country where we're going to have to stop adapting. We're going to have to stop conforming to the world, which is ever-changing. And we're going to have to start gazing on the truth. We're going to have to start welcoming it with all of our hearts into the inner chamber of our souls, and we're going to have to welcome it in and be changed by it and become more permanent ourselves, transform from glory to glory, or we simply won't be willing to pay the price that we're going to have to pay. That's why I love Gutenberg. They've been doing that. They've been, can I politely say it this way? Endearingly say it this way. They have been obstinately fixated on being what they are. They haven't been adapting. That's heroic. That's heroic. And everybody who's come into their orbit because of that has been blessed by it. So we have to gaze on the truth, not as a proposition, but as a person and as a form and as a content. We need to simply be welcoming it in. And any truth. Any truth. The distributive property helps prepare you for martyrdom, especially if you don't like math. It's probably best if I stop there. Does that leave any time for questions?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. How many threads do you have loose in your heads from what I've been saying? I mean, the basic point, you know the Sunday school story about the kid and the teacher says to the class, what's gray and furry and has a big tail and four legs? You know this one? The kid raises his hand, he says, sure sounds like a squirrel, but I I guess the answer is Jesus. Well, the fact is he was right. That's all I'm talking about. It's just Jesus, the incarnate Logos. Yes. Well, okay, I have made a covenant with a woman that from the moment that I covenanted with her to the day that I die, I would love her. And I don't have any choice now, okay? There are times when I look at her and I think, I'm the luckiest human being alive, when I realize that. Okay. There are other times when she just annoys me. It's harder to love her when I don't feel like loving her. Okay. But when I feel like loving her, it's easier to love her. Okay. I can enjoy it more. Now, I have no excuse during those moments when I don't feel like loving her for not loving her. But the fatal mistake in our culture is we think that feeling that you have toward that person is love. Right? That desire that you have to unite yourself to that person, that is love. Well, it helps you love. Love for Christians is acting toward a person in a way that blesses that person. That's what love is. That's what God is doing continually for us, to us. He's constantly loving us by moving us toward what he wants us to be. If I can feel all kinds of desire to be united with a woman and absolutely destroy her by being united to that person, that's not love, right? So, but it's a lot easier to do if you feel like it. So the emotions can be used to support what is right. And when they're not, you just go take an aspirin or something. Or get drunk, I don't know, whatever. Just kidding. Live with it. You have to live with the fact that your emotions come and go, but the commitment can't. Let me even change that from commitment. Let me say that the continual move to embody the truth of love in that relationship has to be ongoing, whether you feel like doing it or not. Does that help? Anything else? Any other questions? Yeah, the other one would be, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. I think that's the perfect prayer to pray when you see a beggar, when you see a person who's down and out. Because I'll tell you what, your soul is always praying one of those two things. It just is. It's in there, right? Whether you put that in words or not, that varies from time to time. Sometimes you're conscious of it. But you are always saying, God, I thank you, I'm not like that person. Or you are saying, God, have mercy on me. That's why people gossip. That's why people criticize. That's why people, you know, say bad things about others. It's why? Because we're saying, God, I thank you, I'm not like that person. The only cure to that I'm aware of is to say, Lord, have mercy on me, the sinner. Yes. The fact is, that's where we all live. Right. We're either at the bottom in the cave chained up, or we're in the middle. Pardon? Yeah. Yeah. Well, that just proves you're bound. The way I would put it is that the process... Okay, let me go at a very global sense here. We live in a creation made by a creator, and that means he is, as we know him at least, initially and perhaps foundationally, an artist. Okay, we are his image. I am an ontological, my metaphysical commitments are that we live in an artistic world. Okay, Genesis 1 lays out a pattern that I think is both extremely practical for how to live our daily life, and it is the pattern of artistic creativity. For example, when you walk into the studio, first you turn the light on. Every single move that we take toward expressing a truth, and pause, comma, no, brackets. Let me repeat that in the bracket. Every single move that we take toward expressing a truth, comma, and the modern obsession with self-expression or manipulation of an audience in that negative sense, in that selfish sense, or not believing that there is a truth to express, which is what is at the root of modern art, these undercut every movement that we are trying to take toward truth. They are fundamentally non-artistic. Okay? End bracket. Every move that we take toward trying to put into an artifact a truth, and by artifact I mean action, painting, song, sentence, verbal expression. In other words, anytime we try to express a truth, it's always partial. Okay, even if we use exactly the right words, we don't mean them exactly rightly. We don't understand each of those parts. Therefore, we are always in that middle stage that you describe in this life. We always see through a glass darkly said Paul in a moment of Platonism. We always know in part. It is always true that if anyone thinks he knows, then he doesn't yet know as he ought to know. I mean, that's a freakishly Platonic statement by St. Paul. We are, therefore, always in the situation of a Dale Earnhardt deciding whether to pass. We're always in the situation of Grant deciding what chord comes next. We're always in the situation of a person talking and stuttering because he's not exactly sure how to get it expressed. We're always, this is what's ironic, as artists, we are always experimenting. And what are we looking for? I heard the phrase, it feels right. I heard the term harmony. How do we know that it feels right? What makes it feel right? There's something within us that wants harmony. There's something within us that wants everything to fit together. You know what that thing is? It's the law. It's the wisdom and law of God written in your heart. Because the fundamental principle of the law of God is that Christ is the one in whom all things are made one. Everything is made one. This is what I meant by taking possession. The rise from the cave, to use Plato's metaphor, the rise from the cave out into the field, out past the flame, where you can see light itself, that rise is the process, that movement is the process by which we ever expand the harmony of how we see things. In fact, I'm going to argue that what makes a great artist better than a lesser great artist is not technical skill, it's how much he can bring into his artwork and harmonize it. Okay, so somebody made a crack about the Beatles. I think, Grant, was that you? Somebody talked about the Beatles, commenting on the relative simplicity of their music. The extent of the harmonizing that the Beatles could achieve was better than, say, Ted Nugent. But it wasn't as great as Bach. Okay, the limits of the harmony that an artist can bring in are what determine his greatness. Exactly the same in a classroom. If a teacher has a student that he can't bring into a harmony, I know there's rebellion here, I understand that. But basically, if a teacher can't bring a student into the harmony with the classroom, at least in the moment moving towards something, all other things being equal, he's not a very good teacher. That's what a teacher does. He arouses the energy of all the minds in his presence, and he directs them toward an end together. And if there's a certain kind of pattern student that he can't contend with or can't deal with, he's not as good a teacher. So what we do in our culture is, since we don't care about harmonies, because we don't believe that all things fit together in one, because we don't have a sun in our solar system, we have to manage all these planets that are bouncing off each other, and we study how to manage the planets bouncing off each other instead of just putting the sun back where it belongs. Do you see that? Tucker, you had a question. Did I answer your question, or did I wander so far from it you lost interest a while ago? It is the journey, yeah. And I think what I'm trying to get at is the journey toward the light, right? Matthew Arnold wrote, rigorous teacher seized my youth and purged its flame and something its fire, showed me the high white star of truth, there bade me gaze and there aspire. Right? I don't care what else you do in a classroom if you do that. If you are directing your students toward the truth, everything else you do will be right because it'll be experimental and you're just trying to find the truth. If you've got a technique for teaching, it's not going to work. It isn't. An art, yes, but not a technique. Tucker. Yeah. Right? Well, and you never do when you begin. Yeah, and it's so interesting because that on the one hand, I say we do that. You can't not do it because it's what we're made to do. But then when we get into it, we don't always realize it's what we're made to do. So then when we try to teach, you know, what we actually do most of the time when we teach is we take, this is my favorite metaphor. You want to give your kid a dog for Christmas, right? So what you do is a person with common sense would take the dog and I would put a dog in a cage and then I'd wrap it with loose paper so air can get through, right? And about an hour or two before the kids come down, I would put it under the tree so that it could make a mess of things down there. And then my kids would come down and they would unwrap it, right? They would unwrap it and then they'd be hearing it, right? There'd be all this noise and then they'd get so excited, right? They would love the dog. Okay, but what we do is we take the dog and we tie it down in the backyard and we run over it with the lawnmower. And then we pick up the parts and we put it in a box we close the box, then we wrap up the box, and we put it under the tree. We say, I got you a dog for Christmas. They open it up, and there's the dog. And they walk away, and they're repulsed by it. And then you go running after them. Why don't you love it? I loved it. That's what we do to learning to our kids. We go around killing these animals that they should be playing with. Because here's the thing. If kids like dogs by nature, let me tell you something else kids love by nature. They love learning. You don't have to cultivate the love of learning in a child. You don't have to do anything to increase their love of learning. It's all they want to do. What you have to do is stop telling them something is learning that isn't. You have to let them actually learn and show them how so that they can discipline it and grow in their learning and not think that only what is academic is actually learning. We love perceiving truth. We love perceiving truth. The only time we don't is when it means we have to change our behavior. We love the truth. We love what is good. We love what is beautiful. Right. Take Adam and Eve. I've been thinking about this. Adam got to name all the animals. So what's Eve supposed to do? Memorize the names? Right. And maybe some people would be happy with that. But surely when Adam was teaching the names to Eve, I don't know if they ever got around to it, but surely when he did, had he done so, he would have done more than just give her pictures and names. And the names can stand between the person and the thing we're trying to get them to see. You talked about your sister. That really struck me. There was something other than the music that you wanted us to see in the music. Mm-hmm. An idea, a logos. And you took that thing that's way bigger than just your song, and you put the whole thing into that song so that we could see something through the song. And that's the whole thing I'm talking about here. As Christians, we believe in a knowable truth. It's eternal and invisible, and it's a rainbow. It's one and it's many, but we believe in knowable truth. There is an art of fishing for that truth. And you have to love the truth so much that by pursuing it, you learn that art. And to the extent that you've mastered it, you lead others along the way. But again, to reduce this, there is something there besides the music. Something there that the music is about. Something beside the sentence that the sentence is about. Something besides the painting that the painting is about. Do you see how by nature we are artists? But the quality of art is determined by how well we see the thing that we're trying to show to other people through our art. And they won't be able to see it a whole lot better than us unless they have a whole lot more art to look at. As teachers, that's what we're doing. We're taking truth and we're embodying it in some kind of artifact, verbal or other way, so that it reaches the child through the senses. But the goal is always not, please hear this, the goal is not that they will remember the words. The goal is not that they will score well on a test. The goal is that they will perceive the truth that you have embodied in this artifact. And if that's not the goal, everything will disintegrate. And that's built up, the whole curriculum is all the different ways. That's what the seven liberal arts were, the trivium and the quadrivium. You know what they are? They're tools, they're means of perception. And I will stop now.